to be somewhat older than Harry, was perhaps in his mid to late 30s, and Harry could have been anywhere from his late 20s to his mid 30s. And even though he, like many Inupiat Eskimos, smile readily among strangers, you couldn't help but note a certain emotion of being back in a home village after years in the army. I'm sure it was not an easy transition for those who settled in the small place. And I don't know what happened to both Harry Outwater and to Fred Goodhope, but I'm sure that Fred Goodhope stayed either there or at Shishmaref, because he was later involved, as I understand, in reindeer herding. The date that we arrived, the notes say, was July 28th. We departed during it on that same day, July 28th, we departed July 27th from Deering, and we stayed overnight at the Stewart's or the Casa de Paga mining camp. Then on the July 28th, we traveled with the Go Devil and the Old Fortson Cat to the Trail Creek. I imagine that we stayed up late. The nights were beginning to darken some in late July. We had a Coleman one burner, as I recall, one mantle gasoline fueled Coleman lamp, one with a bulbous base and a flat bottom, and a main stem, and then some of them had glass windows around them, but I don't remember if ours had that. And we could have used that at the night in the tent. I'm sure we did later on in August. But anyway, Harry left that next morning with the cat. Each time you would go with it, it was not just a simple thing usually of firing up the thing, but I don't have any notes about unusual amounts of time spent trying to get the cat fired up, get its engine going. The very next day, July 29th, after Harry left, we began digging in Cave 2, and I found two broken parts of arrowheads that were modern, relatively modern, say within the last several hundred years, in the surface. The Cave 2 was, like all the caves, it's such a beautiful setting. You have these cascading slopes of green, mainly dreas, and with the little white flowers during parts of the summer, little tufts of white when the seeds are on. And you also have this low mat also has very tiny dwarfed willows and so-called crowberries or blackberries and so-called lowbush cranberries. But these things were very, very tiny and were not productive, very productive. And at places, in damper places, you had a few little tiny blueberries, and some of those had a few berries on them. The cave, too, takes some work getting down, up and down. You begin to feel like a mountain goat or plain goat. I don't really recall that I had a wheelbarrow in 1949. I say I had a wheelbarrow because I was the one who did most of this kind of work, you know, the unskilled labor work. And Helia was in by no means a slacker, and he was kept meticulous notes. I'll mention our clothing. Have I mentioned that before? Anyway, Helia wore cotton clothes, drill pants, sort of a neutral beige cotton pants. And he had shoe packs, shoe packs, mine were. And he wore cotton underwear, white cotton underwear, which always looked clean. And he had on, a cotton shirt. And I know that he had this long jacket, somewhat long, went over the hips. It was a light tan cotton jacket with very big pockets in which he kept notebooks and pencils and various things that he needed at the digs and for just noting things. And of course he also had his Leica camera and his light meter, since in those days Leicas didn't have or any other cameras didn't have an integral light measuring device. When it was really cold, he put on his Point Hope fawnskin parka that he bought in probably 1939 at Point Hope. And it had the fawnskin, which is very fine, soft, was turned inward, and it had a wolverine ruff, and then it had a nicely tailored cotton covering. And we both wore cotton gloves working and digging, although I often had mine off, and I don't remember whether he did or not, but he had to do so much writing, I'm sure he did. As we were pondering the cave two, what to do, of course, Helia was deciding what to do, but he shares his thoughts with people, certainly did with me, and we discussed how best to approach this, and one could see evidence of ground squirrel, Sitellus, diggings all around in this mixture of marble fragments and soil, roots of plants, and it was a loose and sort of a sweet smelling mixture of soil. It was sweetest smelling soil, and the site was like being in a little castle or something around the caves. On the right, as we faced the cave, the deposits that had built up from wind-carried soil fragments, I suppose, dust, and the disintegration of the rock had filled the cave up a meter or a little over a yard or around that in height up to the ceiling of the cave at the entrance. And so it was not... We were not going to start in the cave. Of course, he decided to start digging out at this sort of small fan-shaped area from which the deposits, the soil and the intermixed with the rock, came out and then fell off sharply down into a steep talus that is a broken, sharp, angled, crystalline limestone that cascaded down to the creek. And the cave, I don't remember the exact height above the creek, it must have been 20 meters or so in vertical height above the bed of the creek. And a person would not want to just try to walk up and down that talus slope. It was much too steep to do that unless you had to. So we began with we used a trowel. Each of us used a trowel, and as I recall, he had small spatula instruments too that we had, stainless steel spatula instruments, perhaps dental or some other geological use. But on the outside of the cave, really, it was soon evident once we cut through. We had a shovel and cut through the number two shovel, the old standby, and we cut through this surface, the sod, and the jumble of rocks. And as I said, it was evident that this was not going to be a neat little stratified midden that came out of the cave. Therefore, before too long, Helya decided that, what with all of this, the ground squirrel tunnels and digging and pieces of ground squirrel skeletons, it was all intermixed in this soil and rock, that there was no point really in approaching it from idea of strata, but I'm sure that he sorted things according to depths. As I recall, he had a system for sorting things according to their depth, and he placed things very precisely on his notes as to where they were found. We had we used a metric system for all of the measurements, and Helya, of course, took many photographs. Therefore, his collection must be very, very rich one. And Helya used probably exclusively color film, and I know he said he always used Kodak film, and that was the old Kodachrome with a very, very low ASA rating. And so the conditions were more demanding for outdoor photographer or cave photographer than they are now. My notes say that on July 30th, that is the day after the one on which Harry Outwater left and on which we began to examine and work at the mouth of Cave 2, that we found a modern arrowhead, but nothing else besides bone fragments. And we cut the deposits to a depth of about 1 meter. I suppose the deposits were maybe 3 meters, that was 3 yards wide. My notes say that on the evening of the July 30th, quote, "I am dog tired at night, fell into sack at 7 p.m., but sleep poorly. Then on July 31st, I was sick, tried to work in the forenoon, and got sicker and went to bed uncomfortable, day and night with a bad cold and ear trouble. August 1, sick still, windy weather, some sunshine," and it doesn't go on beyond that. August 2, up and almost well. On August 2, the notes say that I'm up and around and going to work, and it also says that Helya found a Putak, that is about 1,500-year-old flaked point in a root layer 3 meters from the mouth of the cave. So that gives us some idea of how big this deposit was in front of the cave. Probably ran, maybe 3 or 4 meters out from the cave, and could have been more than 3 meters wide. I also mentioned that the two of us found several pieces of very dark bone in a yellow clay layer, and found at one chalcedony point, 110 centimeters, that'd be about 43 inches below the surface, which again gives you some idea of the depth. When we came to work, we had to get all the daily tools and supplies that we didn't leave at the cave. We didn't bring the shovel back. But we had each, I had a pack board that I remember, and I can't remember if Helya had one or not. It was a shoulder, a bag type thing. Seems that he carried a bag. And I believe that we ate down there just on good weather, that we sprawled out and ate on those nice slopes, although you have to get a toehold so that you don't start skidding on the steep slope in many places. But our food was pretty restrictive, but everybody's food was pretty restrictive in those days. It wasn't a balanced diet. And I know that one of our staples was pilot bread, the sailor boy pilot bread, which is a universal food on the coast in those days. And we had peanut butter, and we had Spam. And I don't think we had any condiments to speak of. And we had only water to drink. Trail Creek snow water. I think actually that we had some coffee and tea. And some other things I remember, our food, we had slab bacon, which I would watch and try to worry that it was going to get too moldy. One of our main breakfast would be oatmeal with sugared, and we had butter in tins, those probably 2-pound tins. Was it Dairy Gold? I can't remember the brand name. We had condensed milk in those old, are they 12-ounce cans? And we had raisins, and we had cheese, block cheese. Perhaps it was Tillamook or another brand of cheese that comes in those waxed blocks. And we had jam. So our noon meal often, almost always, would be, or was always, it had a base of the pilot bread, and then it had a slice of cold meat on it, or a jam and peanut butter. I don't recall if we had eggs. We probably may have had a few that we brought in, but it could not have been a main element of our diet. We had also, I remember, several tins of those flat tins of Argentine beef. I want to say a few words about our camping. I have mentioned earlier about our getting water in a bucket. Generally I did, perhaps always I did. And our tent, the small wall tent, was adequate. And we, especially since we had our cooking in this rock shelter-like cave or shelter within a few paces. And Helya worked while I would be ordinary. We must have taken turns cooking, but I really don't remember just how we worked things. And we had simple metal plates, few utensils, few pots and pans, and inside the tent, of course, the dryness of the substrate and the thin mossy cover and the rocks made a rather dry. Ordinarily a dry place to put your bedding, although there's always dampness out in the country. So that wasn't a problem. The ground, of course, is a little irregular, and we had no underlayment that I recall, anything, a mattress of any kind under the sleeping bag, at least I didn't. And Helya would sit in the evenings working on his notes from the cave while I was doing chores. he sat at the, would be the south south end of the short, the end of the tent without a flap, and would work in the tent. Being white, admitted light, so we didn't need light until got into August. I believe then we began to use the lamp some, the Coleman lamp some, in the tent at night. And of course, it was, it became to be utilized in the cave as we got inside. During the time that I was ill, that would have been July 31 and August 1, and was up probably not fully effective on August 2nd, Helya worked on was working on at the entrance of the cave, and he was never, as I recall, we never had any problems, say, with him complaining that I was that time or any other time that I wasn't doing my part. Of course, I was a good hard worker. I've always been, and I have notation that in this old notebook that we started on the cave proper in the afternoon. I remember that when we had the had reached this face of the meter squares, he always worked in dividing his digs into meter squares. We had this beautiful, interesting banded color at the mouth of the cave, the fill of the cave. And there were these beautiful earth colors, yellows, browns, and purples across this face. And Helya, remember Helya photographing it, and the depth of it when we stood a number two shovel against the face, it was pretty much the same length as a number two shovel in its handle, when the shovel stood upright against the face. And I'm sure there were some photographs taken of just this, the cave face cut, you know, right up against the rock wall of the, from which the cave was formed, with the shovel standing there. And from that point on, as we got inside, on August 3rd, we're working apparently in the cave. On August 4th, it's a rainy day and we're inside the cave. At that point, this broad entrance tunnel or passageway into the room of the cave, which is much deeper than the room, and the floor sloped up steeply. This provided a rather well lighted area, and there was some vegetation, little small growths, such as there were a few little vegetative growths for some way in the cave, and we had light that we could work with. We didn't need the lantern in the first meters going in. August 4th was our first big find, and I have this notation that H was on fire. I think this means that that he was terribly enthused when we found the lamellar flake, and I have this brief, and the way I wrote, it's definitely pre-Aputak, nearby artifact. The reason the lamellar flakes had a lot of meaning, I believe that Giddings was also dealing in this sort of thing, and Helya, of course, knew Danish and European archaeology. And the lamellar flakes had a age meaning to him, and he was after old things. He definitely was. My notes on August 4th say, the light conditions inside the cave entrance were bad by late afternoon. We have fixed the Coleman lantern this evening so that we may use it for illumination tomorrow if need be. And indeed we did. And from that point on, it was a matter of severe eye strain. with his brilliant blue-white light of the lantern throwing intense shadows, every particle and little rock and irregularity cast a deep, deep shadow, so the contrast was terrific and the eyes complained. So by the end of the day, my eyes would be dry and aching from the strain. As the flint work began to show up here and there, this was not something like some midden where you just pick up things right and left. As they began to show up, these large, diagonally flaked implements showed, and no one at that time had ever seen them before, at least nothing quite like it in Alaska. And Helya was prone to call it a Yuma point, where he found these implements. Often they had been broken, and sometime meaningfully, they had a Buren spall taken from the front of them, of the blade, used the smaller end of the blade where the strike had been made. So they were used as tools. I assume that they broke, and then the broken arrowheads were used as for incising cutting with the Buren face. From here on, I begin to, in a somewhat jumbled way, describe the various layerings 1 and 2 and layer 3 that Helya had divided in, and these became very intricate and very confusing, and ultimately totally confusing. In Helya's final report, he more or less throws in the towel as far as being totally sure where everything is with its convoluted solar fluxion or frost moved, however they moved, and these clay layers which would form rises, fall, tongues, and all kinds of strange movements down the cave floor at the time they were deposited. On August 5, I have notation, rather cold and windy, proceeded with meter 2 in cave 2. It was in this section where I worked usually on the left side, and here we found at 110 centimeters a lamellar flake, and it was to be in the same base area of the deposits in open openings down in, where I found these elements, these slotted end blades that are quite old. And these were very exciting times for Helya, and he was not sure that the flakes fit into the side blades, but of course, being the confidence of the ignorant, I was sure they did, which was true. I remember distinctly one beautiful little sharp, probably bone point rather than antler, and it had these little finely etched zigzags in the length of it. I believe there may have been two opposing zigzag rows. Very, very exciting. In the first week of August, we're progressing into the cave, encountering these dreadfully complex layerings, and I'm making the few notes that I have, which are nothing, of course, compared to Helya's on the scene. Mine were made at home at night and depended on my memory. And Helya, I believe he had one of those protective pads of aluminum, perhaps, hinged at the top, and he, as far as I recall, he kept his notes all in Danish. The few times I didn't look at him, of course, at night, when he was sitting down at the end of the tent, but in the daytime, the few reasons I had to see what he was writing was in Danish, that I recall. In the meantime, I had all these enthusiasms. There were caves galore, And my notes don't say everything that we did, but we would scout. We began to scout around and find all of these fabulous little and big caves, and what could either be called a rock shelter or a cave. That is, a rock shelter being something of a very long opening, a very wide opening. And the one that I sometimes call five was vast by my scale of things, but it was very low and had a lot of rocks covering its very little headroom, and so crawling back in it was hard on the knees. We went down to the creek, I recall, in that area, and scouting around, and saw these two or three, several caves that are up highly inaccessible. I believe that Gene Schaaf said that they were indeed treacherous getting in and out of, and they were just sort of hanging there. And we didn't really put any effort to, I remember climbing up in one, perhaps the easier, and looking in and maybe prying around a little bit, but we didn't put any serious effort into them. And I think Hilliard didn't think that they were probably used much by people, but of course we didn't really know. And when we walked, I'd sometimes walk up the creek, and it was very interesting to look up and see cave two from the bottom of the Talus slope. And the as you look, it's sort of a dizzying angle as you look up, and this on the as you're facing the cave and the Talus slope, on the right side